Okay, again, starting in verse 7 and going through the end of verse 7 of chapter 11 and going through the end of Ecclesiastes. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So, if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vapor. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vapor. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, and the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home. And the mourners go about the streets, before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, or vapor of vapors, says the preacher, all is vapor. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. This is the word of the Lord. Have you ever met someone who's had a near-death experience? These moments can radically transform someone's life, because they're forced to reckon with the fact that life could end at any moment. It's fleeting. It's like a breath. It could all be over in a snap. Therefore, they understand we should live life to the fullest as long as we can. So this person would agree with our speaker, Kohelet, in point number one, enjoy life. In verses 8-9, God commands us to enjoy all the years of our life. We're to constantly remember that death and the sufferings that precede it as we enter into old age, such as physical ailments, forgotten dreams, lost friends, those things are coming. And because of that, we are to enjoy life as much as possible for all of our days, but especially in our youth, while it's easier. Now, you may not think that you are a youth, but youth is a broad term here. It basically means younger than going to your deathbed, which is what the poem describes in chapter 12. Yeah, so you can walk out today and think, hey, I am a youth. So just maybe let Gage and Ryan know before you show up at youth group so you don't. In verses 8-9, sorry, that's the wrong point. Let's look at chapter 12. Okay. Verse 1 talks about your youth before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. And then verses 2 through 5 go on to explain those evil days and years as the curse of approaching death and old age. So verse 2, Kohelet speaks of the constant presence of storms and night, which cloud out the sunshine and rain. Likewise, sufferings are constant in old age, rather than merely being setbacks when you're young. So for example, when you're young, you might break your leg, and that's sad, you might miss your soccer season. But very likely, the very next year, you'll recover and you'll get to play soccer and run and jump just as hard and as fast as you could do previously. It was merely a setback. But unfortunately, in old age, you just don't bounce back physically nearly as fast or to the same degree. The rest of these metaphors depict a crumbling old house. And while their individual meanings are somewhat debatable, they all certainly communicate a person approaching death. Verse 3, the keepers of the house are a person's arms, which start to tremble. The strong men refer to legs, which are now bent with age. The grinders are teeth, but there are few left. The windows are eyes dimmed by cataracts or loss of vision. Verse 4, the doors refers to ears that are hard of hearing and thus shut to the noise of a busy street. The rising at the sound of a bird refers to the difficulty the elderly can have sleeping. Verse 5, the almond tree blossoms are pale and thus refer to white hair. And the grasshopper, which in its prime could jump all over the place, now drags itself along like an old person's walk. There are other difficulties that come with being elderly, according to verse 5. There are fears, like falling or being attacked. Today, that fear might more commonly be of something like being scammed online. And the elderly also suffer from diminished desire. The reason for all these sufferings is that this elderly person is approaching death. He is, according to the end of verse 5, going to his eternal home. So looking back at verse 8, we can now better understand the days of darkness. Kohelet is primarily referring to the constant sufferings of old age, which come to everyone if they live long enough. His point is not that you can't enjoy God in the midst of your sufferings in old age, and I'm going to speak more to that point later, but rather here, Kohelet is recognizing that it will be more difficult to find enjoyment at that point in your life. There are certain things that you just can't do in old age that you can do while you are young. So, he says you are to make the most out of your life and enjoy it as much as possible. All your days, but especially when you are young and it is much easier to enjoy. And that's what I'm going to focus on for the rest of this point. There are two sayings that have stuck with me as I've studied this passage. And the first is, youth is wasted on the young. I'm sure if you asked any elderly person what they would do if they could be 20 years old again, they would have grand plans. It probably would not be watch more Netflix, or even simply work more. No, they would run a race. They'd go play football. They'd spend more time with family. They'd learn how to play an instrument. They'd go get another degree. And this is because they understand that the gift of youth is fleeting. The time to enjoy all these things passes quicker than you think. And the other saying is, inside every old person, there is a young person wondering what happened. When you're young, you just don't recognize the gift you have been given. You think life is always going to be the way that it is. It's been said that when you're young, you feel as if you are one of the immortals. You don't think about old age, your body feels great, and it seems like this will last forever. But it's not true. And we see dads learn this lesson every time we have a father-son sports event here at the church. Dads think that they are still 21 and they run and jump just as hard as they would have at that point. And inevitably, in the midst of competition, one will leave with a torn hamstring, Achilles, or ACL. It's a hard reality check that our bodies are not what they once were, and they aren't going back either. Nevertheless, dads, as we seek to apply this passage, don't let this scare you away from playing with your kids, because it's only going to get harder. So just go easy. Now, going to verse 9, Kohelet specifically addresses young people. He encourages them to rejoice, or even better, enjoy life in their youth. You're to let your heart cheer you and follow what is delightful to your heart and eyes. Now, this sounds unbiblical to us. We're not supposed to follow our hearts, right? The heart is deceitful above all else, isn't it? Well, it can be, but only when it desires things contrary to God's intended purpose. You must measure your heart's desires against what the Bible tells you is good. And so we see a similar command in 2 Timothy 2:22. Flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. Now, some people have a skeptical view of Kohelet, of the speaker here, and think his use of the word translated vanity, as it is here in the ESV, simply means meaningless. Thus, they might interpret him as saying here, just do whatever you want, sin with abandon while you are young to enjoy life, because ultimately, life doesn't matter. But in fact, Kohelet is saying the opposite. At the end of verse 8 and verse 10, vanity should be translated simply as something like brief or a breath. So what Kohelet is actually saying is that life is precious and immeasurably valuable, but it's short. Therefore, you need to make the most of it and enjoy it as much as possible. He's not excusing sin. That's still off limits for the Christian. But this world was created good and as a gift for you. And that goodness was not completely lost in the curse from Genesis 3. Thus, we are called to delight in God's good creation. Verse 9 ends with these words. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. The ESV is missing the definite article that's in the Hebrew, which would make this the judgment, referring to the final judgment. And there are two possible interpretations of what will be judged. One of the plausible reasons for judgment is for the times that you follow your heart into sin. This would mean that Kohelet is qualifying his previous statement to say something along the lines of, follow your heart, but be careful not to follow it into sin, because sin will be judged. This is orthodox, it's certainly true, and therefore we should be careful about the things that we enjoy are actually pleasing to God. Nevertheless, I think Kohelet is talking about judgment for a different reason, because he says all these things will be brought into judgment. And in context here, it's more likely that he's arguing God will judge people for their failure to delight fully in his creation. So take a moment to consider this. God is not just recommending you enjoy life. He is commanding you to enjoy life, such that a failure to do this to the fullest is liable to judgment. That is how much he cares about you enjoying yourself. How often or ever do you think about God wanting you to have joy? He does. So, go build that Lego set with your son. Come home from work on time to spend time with your spouse. Go to that daddy-daughter dance. Bake that sourdough loaf. Climb that mountain. God is commanding you to live life to the fullest. And remembering who God is will help you both to enjoy life to its fullest and honor God in all your days. And that brings us to point number two, which is remember your Creator. And in chapter 12, verse 1, Kohelet says, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. He calls God the Creator on purpose to emphasize enjoying his work of creation. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were given all of creation to enjoy. Every fruit to eat and find delight in, except for one. They felt that God had slighted them, withheld from them something good. So they disobeyed him by taking the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And as a result, they were cursed with death. Qohelet echoes this curse recorded in Genesis 3:19 to conclude this section, like we do when we say on Ash Wednesday, "You are ashes, or dust, and to dust you shall return." Qohelet in verse 7 says, "The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it." Creation was meant as a gift for man, and it still is, but because of our sin, we don't get to experience it forever. Instead, we suffer the curse of death. Which is, death is, essentially, decreation. Our bodies wither and fail, and ultimately we experience the opposite of life, death, when dust returns to the earth. Qohelet goes on and ends his speaking in Ecclesiastes how he began. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, or vapor of vapors, all is vapor," as it should probably be translated here. And here he is emphasizing that life is short because of death. But in light of the work of Christ, we can receive this final section with hope. "Even if you are elderly and nearing your last days, even as your body fails and withers to dust in the ground, there is wonderful hope because your spirit will return to God who gave it." The Westminster Shorter Catechism is beautiful on this point. Question 37 asks, "What benefits do believers receive from Christ at death?" And then the answer goes, "The souls of believers are at their death made perfect in holiness, and do immediately pass into glory, and their bodies, being still united to Christ, do rest in their graves till the resurrection." Old age is not the end. Death is not the end. For we immediately pass into the presence of our dear Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in heaven and live with him until the resurrection. And remember how the poem described old age as an old, crumbling house, what we went through in chapter 12 here. I want you to keep in mind that metaphor as you listen to Paul's words from 2 Corinthians 5. Paul says, "For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed," and that tent or home he is talking about is your present body, he goes on to say, "we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." And here he's now talking about our resurrection body. He goes on, "For in this earthly tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee." The groanings and pains of old age are not meant to make you pine after the glory days of your youth. They're not meant to make you regret all the things that you never did. They're meant to make you desire the coming life, when you will be clothed in your resurrected body, when you will be even more physical than you are right now. Or as Paul says, further clothed. Remember, God is the creator, and he will create for you a new body after the same fashion that clothed Jesus even now in his resurrection. Therefore, there is no bucket list for the Christian, for you will be able to run and jump and do all the things you didn't appreciate when you were young in the new heavens and new earth. But we're not yet there. Today, we need to remember our Creator, and we do this primarily by recognizing God's creation as a gift and delighting in it. And we don't have to be over-spiritual about this. God created physical things and called them good, and thus it is right and fitting for us to find pleasure in this earthly creation. By evaluating God's creation and seeing that it is good, we are trusting that God is himself good and loving toward us. We don't commit the same sin as Adam and Eve and believe that God is keeping all the good things for himself and wish we had more, 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 never being content with what we've been given. God himself is honored and delighted when we delight in and are content with his gifts to us. Think of the child who opens your gift to them on Christmas morning. You spent so long thinking about what would be just the perfect gift that they could enjoy, and so you're so excited to see them open this. But if they throw a fit about your gift and immediately break it, that doesn't make you feel honored or happy. But if they are happy, if that child is happy and they give you a big hug and they immediately start playing with the present that you've given them, your heart is filled up with delight. And this is how God views us when we delight and find happiness in his creation. And this brings me back to chapter 11, verse 10. And this verse gives us two ways in which we are called to enjoy life to the fullest, and therefore remember our Creator. And the first is to remove vexation from your heart. Vexation, it's not a common word we use today, but it means a state of bitterness. Think about how you might fail to enjoy life when you focus on all the bad things. This can easily ruin any moment that's meant for joy. You graduate from school finally, but you immediately start to dread going to grad school or finding a new job. You get a bonus at work, but dwell on your buddy getting a larger one. You constantly dream of a better house than the one you currently have. These things will all steal joy from your life. Rather than focus on all the negatives, we should recognize that every aspect of our lives is under God's providence. Thus, all the good things in your life are gifts from him, and you do not honor him or even enjoy your current situation when you focus on the negatives and fail to count the blessings that God has given you. Oftentimes, it's easy to look at your life and not see good gifts from God. Instead, you look at things and you see a lot of suffering, and maybe even what seem to be cruel jokes being played on you. Vexation easily builds up when we suffer. Some of you, I know, are suffering from chronic health issues. Some are suffering from loss. Others have been betrayed by close friends or family. And some have children who have walked away from the faith. We don't respond to these situations with happiness or lightheartedness. How could we? It's actually right to express anger in these situations, to mourn and be genuinely sad, to address God crying out, "Why?" Job experienced all of these emotions, and he righteously expressed them. He's not called out, if you remember how those discourses go in the book of Job, he's never called out for that lament. But he did sin when he questioned God's justice, when he began to blame God for his problems. It's a natural response, but it's wrong. We may cry out, "Why have you forsaken me?" Or, "Why are you far from me?" David and Jesus both cried these things out. But doubting God's character and blaming him for our sufferings only builds bitterness in our hearts. Suffering is in this world because of our sin, but we can find joy in the midst of these sufferings, in the midst of our days of darkness, when we seek refuge in the Lord. He gives a joy that surpasses all understanding. It may not be equated with happiness or lightheartedness, but it comes with a comfort and a peace that exceeds any earthly pleasure. And as John Piper has said, when we are most satisfied in God, God is most satisfied in us. He is satisfied when we enjoy his good gifts of creation, and he is satisfied when we turn to him in our hardships. Now I want to point you guys to verse 10. Oh, continue in verse 10 to the second command here, which is put away pain. And that's getting ahead of myself. I actually want to look at vexation still. Vexation in different translations is often translated as anxiety or worry. And there's definitely an element in this word that means those things. So I want to look at what it would mean to interpret it that way. When we think about anxiety and worry, those things can easily steal our joy. Even when we're financially secure, you may be worried about your finances falling apart. Or as a parent, you're consumed by worry that your child is unsafe or will make mistakes. Maybe you're a student and you fail to even enjoy learning your subjects because you're so focused on your grades. These anxieties do not allow you to enjoy the good times you've been given. Being anxious does not add a day to your life, nor does it change anything about your situation. Anxiety is the fool's response to the brief nature of life, because it stems from the desire to be in control. It puts us in the place of creator. But if we remember that God is the creator, we can find comfort in his control of all our situations and live in wonder of his provision. Paul addresses the same issue in Philippians 4, saying, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." The second command in this verse, put away pain. Put away pain from your body is specifically what Kohelet says. And his reason is that your health and your youthfulness are fleeting, so you should seek to feel your best and be healthy as long as you possibly can. This is a strong piece of evidence in support of the use of modern medicine. Kohelet has been consistent about the point that we cannot control what will happen to us. So in the midst of that uncertainty, we are to trust God. Nevertheless, there are certain things we can take advantage of by God's grace to help us enjoy life in the way that God has intended it. I'm reminded of the story of a man whose house got swept away by a flood, and so he climbs up on the roof and he prays to God to save him. And eventually, a lifeboat comes up to him and says, "Hey, come on, get in." And he says, "No, thank you. God's going to save me." And then later on, he prays again for God to save him, and a helicopter comes. And they drop down the ladder and they say, "Come on, man, get in." And he looks up and he says, "No, thanks, God's going to save me." And then after a while, he's in heaven. And he asks God why he didn't answer his prayer to save him. And God replies, "I sent you a boat and a helicopter, and you rejected them both." Likewise, medicine, like the rest of creation, is a gift from God. If there are medical remedies to ailments we have, we should seek, within reason, to utilize them for our health and enjoyment. Now, don't make the mistake of letting medicine be your ultimate cure for suffering. Suffering serves a great purpose in the Christian life to cast you on the Lord for your comfort and salvation and to increase your faith in him. But there is nothing wrong with utilizing medicine to get better. This passage is also not commending the idolatry of medicine. You will find that growing old is like experiencing 1,000 deaths. You don't look as pretty as you once did. You're not as skinny or as strong as you once were. And every time we look into the mirror and are reminded of this fact, our pride is injured. Medicine, procedures, and technology can become sinful when they are used to cheat death. And the most extreme example of this would be trying to live forever as artificial intelligence. I know that's not most of us probably in this room, but more commonly, it might be never-ending plastic surgeries or continual steroid shots with the intent of trying to create immortality in this life. That's impossible. Death comes to all, and medicine will never be the ultimate fix to the problem of mortality. But please don't use God's sovereignty as an excuse to not get the treatment you or your family needs to live a healthy, enjoyable life. Taking care of yourself, keeping yourself fit, eating healthy, all of these are ways in which you may remember that God is the creator, because you are valuing his creation by doing those things. And finally, we come to our final point that the author leaves us with, having recounted all of Qohelet's exploration of life under the sun, and that is, fear God and keep his commandments. It'd be so easy for us to focus on these two commands and view the Christian life as one of constant terror of God's judgment and of boring legalism. But fortunately, we know this isn't the case because of Qohelet's repeated command for us to enjoy life throughout the previous section. And we must also balance these commands with verse 10, which tells us that Qohelet's words are words of delight and of truth. Of course, he has pointed out really tough things in life throughout this book, but suffering is a fact of life, and Qohelet gives us wise words to help us trust God and find joy in the midst of difficult circumstances. In fact, you should be wary of books or advice that ignore the reality of suffering or simply gloss over it as an unwelcome subject. That's the point of verse 12. My son, beware of anything beyond these, of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. He's not saying that we shouldn't go to Barnes & Noble or buy a Kindle, or that being an author or working for Penguin Random House are bad career moves. His point is that wise words only come through living life and undergoing the difficult aspects of suffering in a fallen world. Thus, to try to write more books like Ecclesiastes is a weariness of the flesh, because it requires intimate relationship with suffering. This book, for example, is likely the fruit of Solomon's reflections at the end of his life, when he looked back on all his mistakes and failures and was looking to pass on that wisdom to his sons. True wisdom allows us to enjoy life to the fullest, trusting God even in times of darkness. Although Solomon sought to present the words of this book delightfully, sometimes the wisdom is painful. Verse 11 says, the words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. The author is comparing the wise words of Ecclesiastes to a goad, which was a sharp stick that shepherds or ranchers would use, often with nails hammered into them, to keep livestock on the right path or to prod them into action. And if the shepherd didn't have a goad, the livestock might run into danger. There have probably been some messages in Ecclesiastes that have felt like goads to you. Maybe they called out a foolish response that you have particularly struggled with and need to course correct. We all need these painful prods sometimes. Fortunately for us, even though it's painful, the Bible provides these pushes to help us rightly walk before God, to avoid sin, and ultimately to enjoy life to the fullest. The words of wisdom that are included in this book, like the rest of the words of the Bible, come from one shepherd, according to verse 11. And you'll notice that shepherd here is capitalized. The ESV has interpreted this shepherd to be God. And I think the ESV is right here. Yes, Qohelet, likely Solomon, is the direct author of the content of Ecclesiastes. And potentially there's an author who comes in at the end and adds the epilogue. But God, the one shepherd, has superintended all of these words to be infallible and the inerrant word of wisdom for our lives. Thus, we may say that he is the primary author of this book, as he is of the rest of the Bible. And if that's the case, then we should highly value what the scriptures have to say, even over our own opinions. A good benchmark to evaluate your personal relationship to the Bible would be to ask if you were ever surprised when you come to the text. Are you expecting to learn something new about God or about yourself? Ask yourself, when was the last time I submitted to the Bible, especially if it required uncomfortable action or described truth that was offensive to me? We go to the Bible so often just expecting to find support for ideas that we already have. It's amazing how easy it is to want something to be true about the Bible and then somehow find support for the exact teaching or thing we are looking for, even if we have to heavily weight an obscure verse or skip over verses that contradict ourselves. Thus, reinterpreting the Bible is often a moral exercise before it's an intellectual one. But even when it's painful, we are commanded to fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. And we learn how to keep these commandments from our Bibles. He goes on in his last verse, he gives the primary reason for these commands when he says, "For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. He will evaluate every action that we've committed, and it will either be commended as good or judged at the last day, or for the Christian, judged at the cross of Christ. Everything ultimately matters because God cares. If God didn't judge everything, we normally think that this normally seems like something bad to us, but if he didn't judge everything, then life truly would be meaningless. But as it is, life under the sun is vapor. It's but a breath, and therefore it absolutely matters how you live it." And fortunately for us, because God loves us, the fear of God and keeping his commandments actually provide the avenue for us to enjoy life the most. Sometimes sin feels like it would provide the most pleasure, but that kind of pleasure is always fleeting and lackluster. The true joy and commitment and contentment of life lived with God at the center will always provide us with the most satisfaction. And in turn, God will be most satisfied with us. Amen.